still
Okay.
hanging on
Okay.
here. I just wondered I should give a little advert first.
Yeah, go on then, Steve, off you go.
Recording's on.
You could be on the recording, it's fine. Just to say the last 3 weeks are now on audio, if you didn't know, and we got it on a URL called christianovercomer.com. So if someone wants to type that in, christianovercomer.com, if you go there, you'll see all three recordings from the last 3 weeks, which are, and we're happy for anyone to listen to because they were that good. Of course, with Paul, he goes behind the paywall, so you have to pay.
I mean, I get anything.
the other thing is, okay, later on this month, we've got a special thing for kids. If you've got any kids between the ages of 7 and 11, we have a free theatrical experience done by Artless. A lot of you who've been to our conferences know who I'm talking about. It's our son, Johnny, his theatre company. They're doing a special, a 1 hour Zoom special, totally interactive for kids, all to do with the Christmas story, but full of excitement and involving the kids and reacting to them and everything. That's going to be on the 21st, I've forgotten now, 21st of December at 3 o'clock, I do believe. Yep, I think that's a Monday. If you want to come, just email me or just send me an email. It's free if you've got kids. If you haven't got kids, then it's £10. So that's sort of an incentive to try to encourage more kids to come. Even if the kids are on a separate screen, that's fine. You can still come. But try to bring kids because it is a kids' activity. And it'll look a bit silly for the theatrical companies to be faced with a whole load of oldies, because it's not really at our level. And the other thing is, 2 days after that, we're going to have a Christmas telling on the 23rd, 7 o'clock in the evening. It's something I wrote a couple of years ago, which we've done a few times, but never done it interactively on Zoom. It's the whole Christmas story done in the form of a Passover Seder meal type thing. So we sit around a table together and we follow the elements and we follow the story, and there'll be singing and there'll be prayers and all sorts. So it'll be a nice occasion, and that's free. Again, if you want to come, we need you to tell us. Just email me, or maybe stick it up on the chat and Christine will write it down or something. So there you go. So that's just an advert. First come, first served. So over to Paul.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Yeah, it seems strange after having Mike with us for three weeks that he's not here, and suddenly I've got to do something and think of something myself. But I did say last time, and what I want to do is to start by a bit of a follow-up to some of the things that he said. Obviously, there's a lot, there's 4.5 hours worth of recordings to go through, so it can't be a complete recap. But it's a chance to discuss together any of the main points that's come up, or you want some further chat on. So I'm going to get you going, start you off, I should say, with one or two obvious things, so you can be thinking while we're doing this. The first thing I'm going to share is Mike started off. Can you see my screen?
Yep.
Yeah. Mike started off by reminding us that the Christian life is basically a race, not a ride. So I've put together all the six verses that include this idea of it being a race. So I think for 5 minutes, it's worth you looking those up again, getting hold of this idea, getting the feel for it, looking at the context of each of these. And the last one, which is a bit different, I will mention when we've had 5 minutes looking at them. And also at the same time, be thinking about what I want to share, or what I want to ask in the time that follows from what Mike has said. So there's your opening. Those are all the verses that I can find anyway that talk about the Christian life as a race. Thank
Oh, would you like to read them out for the
you
recording?
very much. Good, thank you. See, I'm out of routine on this. The Acts 20:24, Acts 20:24, There's two in Galatians 2:2 and 5:7. Galatians 2:2 and 5:7. And then 2 Timothy 4:7. 2 Timothy 4:7. And Hebrews 12:1. Hebrews 12:1. And then the last one, which I say we'll have to think about a bit differently, 1 Corinthians 9 and verses 24 to 27. 1 Corinthians 9, verses 24 to 27. And it's always difficult to know how long to leave people to look up a handful of verses. But I'll just make a comment or two, even if you're finishing off. And about the last one is slightly different, or appears to be. Remember what we're saying about this race is that it's not competitive. At least we're not competing against each other. There isn't only one prize and we'll see who gets there first. The prize is for finishing. And we're here to help each other, to encourage each other along the way, to keep each other along the path, to keep everybody running along and to help them over the line and bring them back on track, if you like. But we do get a slightly different emphasis in the 1 Corinthians 9, because Paul suddenly talks about a race in which only one gets the prize. Now, my point on this is that any image or metaphor, any sort of picture language or something, it can be used in lots of different ways. Isn't just necessarily one point to get out of it. So Paul is now switching the imagery a little bit to sort of a professional race where only one person does get the prize. But what he's getting at here for us is that the person that actually wins and gets the prize must have done a lot of training. He must have been disciplined. Okay, if there's only one prize and the guy that wins it, he won't have got there just by being sloppy, casual, turning up on the day. I'll see how I get on. So the emphasis here isn't so much on winning a prize. It's on the training that you need to do and not to run aimlessly, not to fight like a man beating the air and so on. It's about self-discipline. So he's picking a slightly different image out of that, and it doesn't sort of change everything before, where the race is not just for the winner, but for everybody. So that happens with images and so on. If you think of another very common one, in the Bible, we like to say, the Lord is my shepherd, and we think of ourselves as sheep. And there's lots of places where the shepherd and sheep imagery is used, and it can be used in lots of different ways. It doesn't mean that God is always a shepherd. Of course he isn't, he's lots of things. And it doesn't mean that we suddenly become only like a sheep. But there are times when that imagery works, because when we act like a sheep, God acts like a shepherd. So it comes into play in a particular way. And you'll find that about lots of illustrations like that. Now, before we move on, I will stop sharing so that if you want to make any comments, anything so far on this basic reminder of the fact that it is a race, not a ride, and that there is training and everything needed? I guess that's pretty clear by now, but I'll give a chance for people to say something before we go on if they want to. Okay, I'm going to go on to some more text then, almost at the other end of things that he said. So if I go back to this, he drew attention to all these verses in Revelation. I'm just going to take you through them again. They're in chapter 2 and chapter 3, but this time I've printed them out, typed them up. I hope they're going to come up. There we go. And I want us just to meditate almost for a while on all these wonderful promises that is given to he who overcomes, and just to try and get them in our heads. Now, one of the questions here is, do we actually understand what all of these actually mean? And I think we'll find in some cases we'll be scratching our heads. Do come in with a brilliant explanation, if you like, of any of these verses. But I'll summarise them towards the end, as once we've been through them. But if you overcome, you are given the right to eat from the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. A right which was forfeited at the very beginning, and we've been denied ever since, but it comes back into play again at the end. And this is a wonderful promise, whatever the image is like. The crucial thing here is it's in the paradise of God. So I may not know what it's really like to eat of this tree, or even what this tree will look like, but if it's in the paradise of God, I want to be there. I want to eat from it.
That's Revelation 2:7.
Thank you very much for recording. Thank you. Revelation 2:7 is the first one. Revelation 2:11 is the next one. He who overcomes will not be hurt at all by the second death. Now, to really get the impact of that, you've got to understand all the sort of things that the Bible talks about in terms of the second death and where that occurs in the whole afterlife. But even if you can't get hold of that, even if that seems to be a bit tough, sort of theologically, or oops, sorry, gone wrong there. The crucial thing that I get hold of there is I won't be hurt by it. And that's good enough for me. I won't be hurt at all. Even if I don't fully understand what the second death is like, okay, I haven't sorted out all the theology of it. I haven't come across it in the Bible elsewhere. It's a promise I won't be hurt by something which sounds as though it's pretty painful or pretty awful. So that is a good enough promise to me. That was 2:11. And staying in chapter 2, verse 17. Well, I get some of the hidden manna if I overcome. I also get a white stone with a new name written on it, known only to me, the one who receives it. What is this hidden manna? I don't know. I mean, it's hidden. Perhaps we're not meant to know. I'm going to get a white stone with a new name written on it. The name will be known only to me. So I'm not going to know much about this in advance. So it's strange. I don't get this. Anyone else got any ideas about either the hidden manna or the white stone? Do chip in with something. I seem to vaguely remember something about a white stone now. Is it what you get if you've been judged and found innocent? Does that come up with anything? Jackie? I can see you raised your hand, Jackie.
Yep, sorry. I think it is to do with being innocent. And I've always just read the manna thing of God's provision, provision for us at all levels.
Yeah.
So for me, it's a bit about being recognised that we're now, God's going to provide everything we need. And the white stone with the new name is something that God's just going to give us as individuals, but it's only known to us because it describes our character. I mean, I don't know, but that's I picked it up from somewhere, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, the great thing about all of these, and it literally is all of them that we're going to look at, they all begin with God saying, or Jesus maybe saying, "I will do this." It's God's promise. It comes from him. So even if I'm not too sure what it is he's going to give me, the fact that he's going to give it, that's enough for me again. Wow, it's God that's going to give me this as part of my inheritance for having overcome, for having endured to the end. So, okay, I don't know what it is now. It's like the presents under the tree. They're all wrapped up and you can shake them and try and get some idea of what's in there, but we may have to wait. That was 2:17. 2:26, authority over the nations. It's an intriguing one. And then it says also the morning star. So in 2:26, I don't know if you want to try and give it some context. I've just picked out the bit that mentions what is given to those who overcome. I will give him authority over the nations. Well, I think the best we can make of that is that because Jesus himself will come back and rule over the nations, it's a promise that we will rule with him. So if he is going to come back as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, if he's going to have the government upon his shoulder, then he needs people to help. So we are going to be given authority, just as he gave his disciples authority when he was here on earth. So there's something linked to what we're going to be doing. And he does say, I'll also give him the morning star. And that's very intriguing because Jesus himself is called the morning star. And I think we might know what the morning star means. It's that star that you see, first of all, bright in the sky when the night is over. And I think it's usually associated with Venus, but you correct me if I'm a bit astray there. but quite what it means for us to be given the morning star as a separate sort of gift. I can't add any more to it, but at least it sounds sort of exciting. That was 2:26. chapter 3, verse 5, we'll be dressed in white, and our name will never be blotted out from the book of life, but acknowledged before my Father and his angels. So that's a great gift of permanence, eternal security. Our names now are absolutely secure in the book of life because we've endured to the end. And dressed in white, obviously, is an image of righteousness, come through everything, and we've stayed faithful. So more great images, even if we don't fully understand every bit of it. And in 3:12, God will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. And he will never leave the temple of God. So again, it's a sense of permanence, like, oh, we're there now. That's it. This is what it's going to be like. And I don't know what you make of this idea of being a pillar. Trying to remember what the old joke is about being a pillar in the church. It's something like tall and solid and gets in everyone's way or something. But I'm sure there's something positive about being a pillar in the temple of God. I suppose because we've stood firm. So it has that sort of feel about it, doesn't it? Of something solid and permanent. But it's, if nothing else, it's a place within God's dwelling forever. And in 3:21, that's an interesting one. Jesus says he gives the right to sit with me on my throne. Well, it's going to be a bit crowded then, that throne. But I suppose it's just an image again, like having authority over the nations under his ruling. We have a part in that. Perhaps it's a bit more like we'll have a seat around the cabinet table or something, or place in the court of the king. But we're sharing in him and his reign in that sort of way. So that's another promise. And I think this one of the towards the end, chapter 21 and verse 7, where it's all summed up really by we will inherit all this, all the things that are mentioned there. I will be his God, he will be my son. And I say that probably sums it up because in the end, hopefully that's really all we really want. All these other things are wonderful, but in the end, it'd be great to know that we are in a permanent and as excellent a position as we can be as Father and Son. We know it now, we experience it now, but not in full. And one day, when we've finally inherited, then that will be the fullness of our experience. So I thought it was worth running through those again. That might be it. It is. Anyone want to comment upon any of those? It's worth just meditating on them from time to time along the lines of, oh, great, this is what I'm heading towards. This is why it's all worthwhile. Now, I want to open it up for different comments as well. I've got one or two more little things to say. And I'm just going to give fair warning to Jackie Cowan, because you've mentioned Nehemiah and you've done some studying, I think even some teaching on it. So if you feel you've got a little bit to share on us from Nehemiah, then would you like to bring that in at some point? I'm sorry I didn't warn you too long in advance, but you can either do it off the top of your head, or you can search for something. I've had a little read of it, but I thought, as you've done a lot more in it, you might want to bring something in due course. But anybody else want to start us off with either a question or a comment or something you remember very strongly from what Mike said and is worth repeating or even asking questions on because you weren't too sure? Who have we got that might want to come in first? Betty?
Yeah, it's just a comment or a sort of musing on the meaning of these. The actual meaning of it presumably rests a bit on when this happens, like where in the progress of Jesus coming and the millennium reign and everything else, whether, because in my concordance here, it refers to being able to spot evil and to know evil. Well, if it's happening right at the very end, evil will be dispensed with. So,
right. Yeah, that's a good point. We may not get all these things all at once.
Mm.
Yeah, it's for whatever particular period we are at the beginning of millennium, end millennium or whatever. Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you. Now, Jackie, you put your hand up. Is that to either say, yes, I'd love to say something now about Nehemiah, or are you going to tell me off?
No, I could do some Nehemiah later. I was just commenting on you've highlighted the promises for the overcomers tonight, which I think is brilliant. But I think it's quite good to go back and match what you've got to overcome first.
Yeah.
Because you know, I think for me it's about, yeah, that's great promises. Thank you, God. And we all want to be there and claim them. But the actual what we've got to overcome can, you know, it's quite challenging, actually. And yeah. I think for me, that they match together better like that. Happy to speak about Nehemiah later if you want.
Yeah, please be ready sometime in the next 20 minutes or so, whenever we... It's part of this section we're doing. Yeah, I mean, I did put down here, so what actually might we expect to face then? And I'm thinking what we might expect to face now or in the near future. What specifically might we have to overcome? Mike talked a lot about sort of our personal overcoming within our own, with whatever it is that's going on in our lives. But there's the bigger picture out there in the world that we're going to have to face together. And so it's worth understanding something of this. And those other verses in Revelation, no doubt, will give us a clue on this. So, yes. If you want to talk into that now, think about what it is we might expect to face in the next few weeks, months, years that requires us to overcome. Do we have any comments either on that or anything else that's been swirling around in all this? See anybody at this point? Ah, Pat, yes.
Well, I was just thinking when you said about thinking about what we might have to overcome in the sort of short term. I think it's something that we've mentioned at the conference and has been mentioned one or two times since the conference, and certainly since, you know, Steve's published his book and what have you. And that is because probably for maybe, I don't know what percentage of people here, but who have been out of fellowship, might be out of fellowship on a permanent basis, but have been out of fellowship because of shutdown and what have you, closed down as I have been, and have made a decision not to sort of go back under the sort of guidance rules, which I think I would find very difficult to deal with. But it's about what we're going to find when we do go back. And that is something that is really concerning me is to what am I actually going back to? Because I think things have changed. You know, there's been a change. I can't really put that into words as to what I mean too much now, but I'm feeling a little bit unsure of the future back in the same system. Yeah. And that'll be something that's got to be addressed by me, my husband, and probably lots of other people.
Very good point. But given we're going through a shaking of many different kinds, that does create, if not out and out fear, perhaps we're not quite as bad as that, certainly uncertainty and the sense of, what next and where next. We're going to have to be strong, because that again was one of Mike's main points, wasn't it? Be strong in the Lord.
Yes.
And that covers everything. So sometimes we go into a future where we're not quite sure what it is we're going to have to face and therefore overcome, but that the preparation is important to cover everything. So is it John or Rose that's coming in next?
It's Rose. Mike Dwight had said that we would have to overcome temptations and accusations. And
yeah.
But I think certainly the accusation will be that we're so intolerant, that we believe all this old-fashioned stuff. And, you know, why don't we just get with the times? And John's brother, who's an atheist, very academic atheist, did say to us once, but you're both so intelligent, how can you not believe in evolution? Just a loving brother. So it's certainly going to be worse. I think, you know, we need to be strong in the Lord, and the temptation would be certainly to stay home, keep our head down, and just nod politely and not fight, not enslave our bodies so that we're ready to run a real hard race.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, thank you for remembering that and bringing it to us. Particularly the accusations, we don't even know what we're going to be accused of, but it will certainly be along the sort of lines you've said, that how can you possibly either believe or have anything to do with or want to follow something as unacceptable, intolerant, and so on, as the Christian faith. And the Bible will eventually become increasingly outlawed as having anything relevant to say, other than just basic sort of how to be nice, how to be good, that the gospel will continue to be watered down, and certain parts of the Bible will be regarded as, well, if you speak it out, it'll be hate speech. If you start to preach it, it'll be a hate crime of one kind or another. So we are going to have to face that unquestionably. While you're thinking of something else, I'll come back to the point about the difference between a temptation and a test, which Mike did mention, and I thought, I'll say something about that eventually. There is a difference between a temptation and a test or trial. A trial is the same as a test. We know where temptations come from. They don't come from God. And the aim of every temptation is that we fail. But the aim of every test that God puts us through, or every trial that we face from God, is not that we fail, but that we succeed. That is the difference between them. That's almost what defines them. And as a school teacher, I used to set lots of tests. It was part of my job. I had to do this. But why did I do it? Not so that they failed, but so that they could show what they could do. A test was always written with a view of, if I make this really difficult, we'll all get no marks and then I'll be able to have a go at them. No, that's not a test. A test is one where you say, okay, show me what you can do. And when you come out with 70%, I will then work with you on the other 30%. I will help you with the bits you still can't do or don't know. So you show me what you can do, and then I can come alongside and we'll work together on how to strengthen you, what's left to learn, and how you can, next time you have the same test, you'll get 75 or maybe 80 and so on. That's the purpose behind the test that I used to set. And I'm sure that's what it means when it says that God tests us, or he puts us through trials, we're meant to count it all joy and so on, because it becomes then a learning experience. It's not God is trying to beat us over the head and show us how awful we are, now we just can't make it. He actually wants to see us succeed and then to be strengthened more so that we become even more overcoming in the future. So I hope that makes sense. I like to use that illustration. We're not meant to be frightened of tests. It is always a bit of an issue. Do you tell a class in advance you're going to have a test tomorrow and get them frantically either worried or working? Or do you just spring it on them as a surprise test? They didn't used to like surprise tests, but actually sometimes that was the best way.
Mm.
So, they'd walk into the room and they'd see that I'd set the desks out differently, and there'd be this big pause in the doorway, deep breath, oh yeah, we're having a test today. You didn't tell us. No, I didn't. Let's see what you can do. But we're not meant to be afraid of tests. They may come upon us suddenly as well. Right, anything else anyone else has thought of at this point? We got Stephen and then Jackie. Stephen.
I just wanted to underline what was commented upon just a moment ago and also touched upon by Mike, which I actually felt could have been, well, it might profitably have been given a bit more timing in terms of the overcoming of fear. And I mention that for a number of reasons. First of all, what's been happening to us over the last 9 months or so mm-hmm. has certainly raised the profile of fear in people's lives generally, but even amongst us as Christians. I'm sure none of us has escaped a certain feeling of dread and concern over what's been going on. And from my observation, some Christians have been particularly weighed down by this situation. But also arising from that, one of the factors about fear is that it does paralyze you. I don't know how many folk here have kind of succumbed to fear, but certainly for myself in the past, I've known that when you're afraid, you're almost struck immobile, not so much perhaps physically, but certainly spiritually. You don't know what to do. You find it very hard to pray, to read the Bible, to fellowship, that kind of thing. That's one of the effects of fear. And I mention that because if we are to run the race, i.e. engage in spiritual activity to help us move on in our relationship with God and his purposes for us, the fact that we are paralyzed spiritually through fear obviously is counteracting that aspect of running. So, it's interesting that when you read the Bible, obviously there are so many, reckoned to be 300 and however many times when God or Jesus says, do not fear. So it's evident that God is aware of the fact that fear is a big factor in our lives and therefore is one which we need to be aware of and need to know the importance of overcoming. Yeah. And in that respect, I found it so helpful. Rose, a moment ago, you spoke, and I remember what you said, quoting from a book about one of the ways of overcoming fear was to sing praises to God. I don't know if you remember that, but that really struck me as being so important. And I felt also helpful to have mentioned that as being very almost a simple way of overcoming, but certainly one which has a spiritual dynamic. And for me, at least, has proved very, very important in moving on from a state of that situation.
Yeah, good. Thanks very much for all that. Mike did say, what would stop you from running the race? And fear would knock us all off if we let it, certainly. So Jackie and then Anita. Jackie next.
I was just wanting to touch on the temptations. I think when we look at Jesus's temptations in Matthew 4, we can see how the enemy is going to try and tempt us. And I think it's also in 1 John 2, 15 to 17, and that's that little phrase, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life. And those are the three things that I believe the enemy is going to try and get hold of us with. And we've also got to look for the internal and the external when it comes to temptation. So that was just sort of my little bit of summary from what Mike said.
Thank you, because that's reminded me of something else I wanted to say. So I'll come to you in a minute, Anita, but the temptations of Jesus, I mean, we all know these so well and how he countered them. Every time he countered them with, it is written. And I'm sure Mike would have said, that it's through knowing the word of God that you strengthen yourself so you overcome and so on. Every time Jesus says, it is written, it is written. And if you think where he was in the wilderness, as they call it, just the sort of the bit outside the city, really. He was led by the Spirit there to be tempted, not by God, but by the devil, but he was led by the Spirit. Somehow God allowed it. Now, you can ask yourself, so what was Jesus actually doing here? He was actually going through what Israel had to do, or what they did go through when they were in the desert and they were being tested, because they were being tested to love the Lord their God with all their heart, with all their mind, with all their soul, and so on. And Jesus is doing what the theologians sometimes call sort of recapitulating it and showing how to win. So where Israel failed, Jesus wins. How does Jesus win? By knowing it is written, it is written. And when you're out in the wilderness, what he didn't have was the actual printed text or written text in front of him. He couldn't suddenly say to the devil, oh, hang on, I know the answer somewhere. I even know it's in Deuteronomy somewhere. Now the scroll's back in the synagogue. Just hang on while I pop back and have a look. It had to be there within him so that he could say it is written, but he didn't have to go and find the writing. It was there in his heart. So the more that we actually store the word up in us, the better we will be when it comes to those sort of temptations. Led by the Spirit, but the Spirit wasn't going to help him anymore. It took the word, the written word, to get him through. Though I'm sure the Spirit was there, you know, helping him as well. incidentally, the devil, in one of the temptations, also quotes the scripture. If you check it out, you find that the devil misses something out. And one of the ways in which we have to learn to be strong and overcome is to recognize when the word is being misquoted or misapplied in some way as well. And you can only do that the more you know it yourself. So that's a bit more on that that I remember. So let's go to Anita next.
You mentioned earlier that the race was Galatians 5:7. Yeah. And I remember when Mike was talking about it in the second session, it struck me that very important word, paraphrasing, who hindered your race? Mm. And I was thinking, you know, when you prepare for a race, you obviously do the preparation. But I think before you even come to how to overcome the temptations and the accusations that is mentioned, is to recognize that what are the obstacles when you're racing? Because it's not just the fear, but I think it could be if you had a failed marriage or relationship or a death, that could be one of the obstacles that will knock you off the perch, as it were. It could be a conflict with another Christian, or maybe a disagreement of a leader that you respect that could actually make you doubt, actually, about what you are running in. And I think there's lots of different obstacles in the race that you need to recognize when you're running so that you can overcome it. So they're not just the most obvious temptations and accusations, but the most insidious and maybe very soft kind of easy targets that you might not be aware of.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. That's a good point from Galatians. You know, you've stopped running. How's that happened? I think that was the challenge that he was saying to them. He called them foolish Galatians, didn't he? But what's got in the way? What's made you slow down or stop and so on? So we need to bear that in mind. Carolyn?
Oh, sorry, me?
Yes, Carolyn, next, please. Thank you.
I wasn't sure if I heard you right. Could you just clarify what you said about Jesus being led into the wilderness? Did you say by the devil and God allowed it?
I said led by the Spirit. After his baptism, it says Jesus was led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil.
Yes.
That's what it says there. So I'm pointing out that the temptations were from the devil, okay, But
yes, and that God allowed it. That's fine. Oh. I must have misheard what you said.
Yeah,
That's fine. Thank you.
But then the main point was that it was through the word of God that Jesus had in his heart, and that he'd learnt, because he didn't know all this because he was the Son of God. He knew all this because he was a good Jewish lad who had been to synagogue, if you like. Mm-hmm. But it's through the word of God. The Spirit probably still helping, but the temptation from the devil. Jackie, do you have anything then on Nehemiah? Then I've got a couple more things to say and we'll move on to something else in a few minutes. But don't feel you have to, but here's your chance.
No, I just, for those that are really keen, I did an hour preach on it and I put it online. So if you want to go to Facebook, it's on my Facebook page or the Church at Stirling's Facebook page, because there's a full hour there of what I felt I got out of it. So there's quite a lot. To summarise it in about 5 minutes is going to be really hard.
That's a fair point. Is there a link you can put on the chat for people to make a note of? Or
I have no idea how to do that. I'll have a wee look when you're talking in a minute.
Okay.
I think for me, though, just some of the highlights in Nehemiah are basically that, you know, he was the king's cupbearer. He wasn't in Jerusalem, but he got a report. And he never stayed. When he went back, he sorted out Jerusalem and the walls and rebuilt them, as we know, in 52 days, and it's only with God's help. But the reality was, he was doing it for his brothers and sisters. What was he going to get out of it? You know? And one of the things that comes up time and time again is that he prays. He prays, he fasts, and he weeps. And, you know, when was the last time we wept over the state of abortion in this country? When was the last time we wept over the state of the country, you know, in God's sight? You know, so it really challenges me, Nehemiah, because it's not just about Nehemiah's personal faith, but it's about his people in the state of disrepair, the precious place, the temple, the city of Jerusalem is in. And if you go through it all, I mean, it really is a very rich one, because people, and I think some of the things in Nehemiah, we will face people, we're calling him a liar, you know, people were accusing him of things that were not true. So there was lies, there was accusations, there was downright people paying people to prophesy against him. You know, I mean, there's just like a whole load of stuff there. And if, you know, if it's us and people say things against us, do we jump to defend ourselves? How do we deal with it? Nehemiah took it every time back to God. And before some things happen, he said, God will do this. With God's help, we will do this. And it was never, I'm here to sort this. It was, God will do this, or with God's help, we will do this. And so I think there's so much in it about community, about being overcomers, about watching what we say about each other, that we don't allow the enemy to use us against each other. And that's not just in Lashon Hara, which is gossip. It's just in so many other ways that the enemy can get in and use something that we've happened to say about somebody, and, you know, gets picked up in the wrong circles. Because I have no doubt I am probably going to be brought up on the hate crime, you know, at some point, because I'm quite vocal, especially here in Scotland. And somebody somewhere will say, well, you said this. And I work for a local authority, and I've got to be really careful what I say when I work with 16 to 18 year olds. Mostly it's going to be 16 to 25 year olds. But in a group of eight, I have worked within a group of eight where we've had, what do we have? Two gay guys, one lesbian, one bisexual, one person that had no idea what their identity was. I mean, that's five out of eight. I think there was only one person that knew they wanted to be a straight person sexually, and the others were completely confused. And that's eight young people in this day and age. And yet I am not allowed to say anything about that. And so, like Nehemiah, he chose the things he was going to respond to, and he always said, with God's help. And that's what I've tried to do at work. But there's a whole, I'll try and see if I can find a link or find something that I can put in chat.
Yeah, that would be great. But you know, you've just done a nice 5-minute summary, which is what I asked for, and you said you couldn't do. Anyway, thank you. I mean, I had a quick look through it, and I just noticed, I'm vaguely aware of the opposition to rebuilding, but these people, Sam Ballot and so on, it was all about mocking them and ridiculing them, but they then plotted against them and they got angry. And the more Nehemiah kept going, the more they seemed to get further opposition. But as you rightly said there, Jackie, he just keeps saying he prayed, he fasted and so on, and eventually the job was done. So there is a lot of inspiration in that, I think. A couple more quick things for me, then we might move on to the second item. But put your hand up if you want to say something. I think it's a point I made at the time. I hope now when we're doing our Bible reading in general, whatever it is that we're doing, every time now there is a verse that talks about enduring, standing firm, or whatever, don't just read over it as though it's, oh yes, it's put there because they needed it or whatever. Spend a bit of extra time thinking about that sort of thing when it comes up, because it's there in so many places in the Bible. I mean, we just talked about Nehemiah, which is perhaps one of the Old Testament books we don't turn to that often, but it'll be there in the Gospels, the letters, and other parts of the Old Testament. So take note of these bits now, spend extra time meditating on them. Don't just rush over them and think, oh yeah, that's not going to be quite what I need at the moment. This is the now word of God to us, overcoming, I think. So there's plenty in the scriptures to help us. And something else that Mike mentioned about Paul was that Paul was very secure about what he believed about the future, about his own personal future, if you like, the afterlife, judgment, and what was to come after all that. And again, it's there in the scriptures for us. It's something we need to build ourselves up in. And it might be that, I'm not talking about, you know, full exposition of everything to do with the end times and whatever. It's just about what it means for a Christian eventually to leave this life, this body, and go into the future with God. And then eventually all the other things happen, like a new body and so on. So the more we can understand, and by that I mean a spiritual thing, not an intellectual thing, about what effectively we might call the afterlife from the scriptures, then that must surely help. So again, don't skip over bits like that, even though some of it might be a bit tough or obscure in places. Any final word on this? Thanks, Jackie. I see now you've put that in the chat. So if anyone... Okay. there's something to help people find it anyway there, even if you don't have direct links on it. I'm sure people can always get in touch with you somehow to find more. Any final comments on that? I mean, we've never finished on this topic, except we've got to. And I think I said it might be very interesting to have Mike back in a few months' time to see how his thinking has developed on it, particularly if he's been able to share it in other parts of the world and so on. Okay, so in the absence of any other more hands or people wanting to make comments, I thought for our remaining time, we'd do what we've done before, which is to look at a particular book of the Bible. And I'll say a few introductory comments, and then it'll take you about 10 minutes to read it, and then we'll discuss what we find. So we're going to do a whole Bible book read through. And the one I've chosen is 2 Peter. So the second letter of Peter. which is just 3 chapters long. So I reckon it will take you about 10 minutes to read it. And I'll just give you one or two things to think about before you start to read. So this is a very late letter. They think it might be even as late as AD 67. His first letter was AD 64. So it looks like he's left it another 2 or 3 years and then written again. It's addressed to the same people, the same readers. You'll find that he mentions his other letter, or at least he says, this is now my second letter to you. And he tells us why he's written them, what the point of them are. But Peter is now very, very close to his own death. He's probably going to be, as you know, he was crucified in Rome. This is probably going to happen very soon. So it's almost his last chance to communicate the things that he wants to share with this particular group of people. And you'll get a sense of that poignancy, I think, as you read it. Certainly when he starts to talk about what you'll call his departure, he knows his time is coming. It was also probably the very last book to be admitted into the canon. I didn't realise that there was some dispute over whether it should be included or not. I don't think there's any real doubt about it now. But some people thought that it might not have genuinely been by Peter. They're going for things like, oh, the style of Greek is different. Is this really the same guy that wrote the first one? Well, actually, there's a simple reason for that. At the end of the first letter of Peter, just before the very last bit in his final greetings, Peter says, with the help of Silas, whom I regard as a faithful brother, I have written to you, briefly, he says, and so on. So in other words, he's had the help of Silas as a sort of secretary or scribe, but he's not mentioned in the second letter. So it's as though Peter had to do it all himself. So that would account for there being a difference in style and maybe even the Greek not being quite as brilliant. So we don't need to worry whether or not it really is by him. It does seem very much as though it is the same guy writing to the same readers, but about a new set of dangers. He's recognising a new threat, a new danger that he needs to alert people to. And I'll just give you a few pointers. Look for the following sort of key words. Something I noticed occurs a lot. He says, make every effort. Now that sounds like an overcoming thing again, doesn't it? So from time to time, you'll hear Peter say, make every effort. So be aware of that. He likes to use the word precious, though he doesn't use it as much as he does in his first letter. But he does use the word knowledge a lot. So that's a sort of key word in 2 Peter, knowledge as well. But the one that I found was make every effort, and it's there a few times at the beginning and again later at the end. So for a few minutes now, I'm going to leave you to read this. There's lots of stuff in it that's fairly familiar. There's some bits that's very tough indeed, and I'm not suggesting we're going to be able to tackle all the different things that he mentions. But we'll see what you get out of it, but still thinking perhaps more than anything else in terms of hearing Peter warning us, encouraging us, and what it is that we need to do to grow in knowledge, to make every effort, and ultimately to stand firm. So I'll give you 10 minutes, which is enough, I think, to read 3 chapters. I don't know whether you want to leave the recording on and then just edit it later. It's probably safer to do that. But I'm going to mute myself, and I'll come back in 10 minutes and see what you want to say based upon reading that. Any questions now? Did I not make it clear? We all know what we're doing. I can safely say goodbye for now. Talk to you soon. Well, that's about 10 minutes, just a bit over, actually. So I hope I've timed that reasonably well. But it gives us a good quarter of an hour to discuss things. Let's not get bogged down in fallen angels and heavens disappearing in a roar. Let's stick to the sort of the main thrust of what Peter is trying to share with us. And I've jotted a few things down, but I'd rather start with something from you, if there's anybody keen to tell us straight away what they've already, what they got it from it. It's Betty again, thank you. You're always there first.
I know. I try not to be poor, but I just say the thing that really hits me is that what the Holy Spirit has done in this disciple Peter, who was frightened and denying Christ and just coming out and think, wow, you know, what hope we have. And then we went on, I picked up, and it was really what Jackie was saying. Well, there was a couple of things actually, but it really stopped me in my tracks when this, if you're better off never to have known God than to have known him and then backslide. And then also what Jackie was saying about Lot, how he was tormented in his righteous soul at the unrighteousness, the depravity of the people around him. And it's that crying out for people that you can see.
Right.
You know, just, you can see what their future is likely to be, particularly if they have, so I'm thinking of people in the church who are misleading other people. You know, they're looking for signs and wonders and all the sorts of things we see going on. And you know in your spirit it's not from the Lord. And part of you is angry and part of you is crying out for them and saying, oh, do you know what you're doing? Sorry, I'll try not to be first each time.
No, please do. Yes, it's going. I mean, the whole thrust of this is Peter is warning of dangers within the church. In the first letter, it's probably more sufferings from outside, but this is about us recognising some of the problems we might face. He talks about those who will secretly introduce destructive heresies and denying the sovereign Lord and so on. Now, the secretly introduce is a fascinating little way of expressing it. Not too sure how it's done in Greek, but it's like they sort of just quietly get alongside you and whisper things in your ears and try and just, you know, slowly, but surely, quietly, and take you away from the true faith into what it is they're trying to make you think about and believe. Anybody else got anything at this point? I don't know if you know this. Miriam. Oh, sorry, we've got someone. That's great. Yeah.
To unmute, Miriam.
It was just, it came over. I mean, I love Peter and I'm often reading it, but tonight it just felt so, this is so our day. And I noticed all the times he says, pay attention, be diligent, make every effort. All those expressions, like there's an urgency to this book for us at the moment. And will remain to be so until we leave the planet. But yeah, it just came over as really urgent.
There is. And because it's Peter's final letter or the last chance he has, he's aware of this. I love the bit from verse 12 where it says, I will always remind you of these things. I will always do this. There's not much time left to do it. But I want you to be firmly established. And I will make every effort to see that after my departure, you will always be able to remember these things. So even though he's not going to be around much, he's going to make sure that this continues. This is the apostolic teaching. This is what everybody needs. So, yeah.
And I think, too, that although, like, we're going to get all the things, or are getting and will get all the things that Nehemiah got, but that was from without. But we are so such in a position now to be getting things from all those people that we may have fellowshiped with or do fellowship with, because they're on a different wavelength and compromising and watered down scriptures and you know, we're going to lose fellowship with brothers and sisters, or who we thought were brothers and sisters.
Yeah. Okay, good. Thanks. I'm glad it comes through fresh when we do it this way. This is not just sort of let's have 10 minutes of silence and whatever. This is about engaging with God through the word and then bringing it together. Is it John again or Rose? Probably Rose. Yep.
Hi. It's the mouth again. We've all experienced that, reading a verse that you were sure wasn't there last time you read the book.
Yeah.
This morning, but just now, chapter 3, verse 2. And I realized that when Peter wrote this, there was no Brit Hadashah, there was no New Testament. But that line that you should remember the word spoken in the past by the holy prophets. What an admonition. We should know the Tanakh. Mm. I don't know how many fellow churchgoers I've met who say, oh, I never read that old stuff. That was the God of wrath. I was brought up Roman Catholic, and we were taught then it was two different gods. The Old Testament was the God of wrath, and this new guy was really nice, and he lets you get away with anything. But that admonition is right there. We need to know the Tanakh.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, Hazel?
Hi, the bit that comes to my mind is, apart from you do well to pay attention, which he says on quite a lot of occasions, because a lot of times we don't and we switch off. But I think the other thing that comes out really important here is that he reminds us that nothing we speak comes from us, that it's all inspired by the Holy Spirit, and therefore we mustn't take credit of our own knowledge, that we must remember that everything we get comes from Messiah.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. Is anybody else at this point? See, one thing I get from reading this is that Peter, he doesn't want to sort of espouse a particular theology. He doesn't want to fall one side or the other on these things. So he always talks about be more eager to make your calling and election sure. Okay, so we need to make every effort. We need to make these things sure. Then if you do these things, you will never fall. So he's both urging us on and also assuring us. And it's a strange phrase towards the end, which, again, I hadn't noticed before. And it's right towards the end. so it's verse 17. And at the end of it, he says, be on your guard. You don't want to be carried away by the error of lawless men and fall from your secure position. So hang on. Is it a secure position or not? and he doesn't seem to bother about the theologies that say, oh, no, you can't fall. You're bound to be secure, or you can fall because you're not secure. He just says it's secure, but make sure you don't fall. And he's always sort of balancing between those two. So he hasn't read his theology textbooks and come down one way or the other on this. He wants us to make even what is sure, even more established, and so on. And he talks about adding to our faith various things. So, you know, we go on about, oh, it's faith and only faith. Well, yes, it is. And he's not adding to faith sort of works and things from us, but he talked about adding to our faith goodness, knowledge, self-control, perseverance, godliness, brotherly kindness, love. And it's as though, you know, this, I think as Mike was saying this before, about faith has to be worked out in these different ways. But to really be a living faith, a faith that works, a faith that acts. And so he's not just saying, okay, you've got faith, you know, you believe in some way. You're on a journey to which you add to your faith, and you add to your faith by your faith as you work out what it is to be good and have knowledge, self-control, perseverance, and then eventually it develops to godliness and so on. If you possess these qualities in increasing measure, they will keep you from being ineffective and unproductive. And then that word knowledge, which I said occurs, I don't know, did anybody bother to count it? Probably not. I think it occurs a good 12 or 15 times, the word knowledge. Anyway, Anita now.
I can unmute.
Yes, you are.
Oh, Paul, what I wanted to say, you said it all.
Oh, okay.
But I think what struck me was that I think Peter was at pains to remind us that when we were born again, it was not not of our own self, but from above. And so that divine rebirth from God gives us that power to do the things that we should be doing. And he reminds us that that we were chosen, the elect, for obedience and to godliness. And so we must have all of the verses 5 to 7. And like you said, we have to keep on doing them, and so that we will not be ineffective. And I think that it is very clear that we are to do them and to ensure that we do them in the way that that helps us through the Holy Spirit, because we can't do it in our own strength, but the Holy Spirit will help us do it. And I think it's very important reminders that we need to be rooted in him and in all those things, so that we can overcome really at the end of the day.
Mm. And that little bit passage he adds at the end, if you don't do this, you are short-sighted, blind, and you've forgotten that you've been cleansed. So, you know, 20 odd years later, you can sort of forget what God has done for you because you haven't gone on in these things. So it keeps it fresh before us all the time, God's grace towards us, how he's forgiven us, because we're going on in that sort of way. And it really inspired me when Mike first started talking about this to think, well, you know, because I've been a Christian now a number of years, because I was converted in my teens, it's easy to lose something of the excitement and the impetus of it. Mm-hmm. And the fact that actually this is the only exciting life to live, really. Otherwise, it is just a sort of a ride which feels a little bit like sort of going round and round on a roundabout, and you just get older and you drop off. And that's not exciting. This is a journey from glory to glory, from faith to faith to faith, and so on. This is what makes life worth living here and now, as well as all these wonderful things to look forward to that we've thought about. So get on the race, get in the race. Stop.
That's what he said when he said, "I will give you life to the full."
Yeah. Yeah. And eternal life starts now, so to speak. It's great. Jackie again.
I like to go through and highlight different words, and I've been trying to do that very quickly, but not quite had enough time. I think the One New Man Bible doesn't really have make every effort an awful lot of times. I've only got it 2 or 3 times. But one of the bits that jumped out at me is chapter 1, verse 19. Is it 19?
Yeah.
Right, and we will have more certain prophetic word in which you will do well if you pay attention, as with a lamp shining in a dark place until that day would dawn and the morning star would rise in your hearts. And it was just literally, excuse me, what we had been talking about, the morning star.
Mm.
And the morning star will rise in our hearts. So is that like a fuller understanding of Jesus?
Yeah, and it was one of the in Revelation, wasn't it, that we wondered quite what it meant. I didn't know there was another reference to the morning star here. that wasn't that wasn't planned. That was coincidence. But it might be that it helps us, like Scripture often does, helps us understand it in other places. So, yeah. Now, I'm not saying make every effort appears sort of all over the place. I've found, I think, 3 or 4 occasions. And Peter himself says, I will make every effort, as well as just telling us to. But maybe different translations will, as they often do, they take a similar phrase but put it in different words from time to time, just to
this one here
a bit fresher. So anybody else with a comment to make?
Yes.
Yes, okay, yes, John, hi.
Hello. I think it's one thing to bear in mind in chapter 2, the danger of false teachers. And I was speaking to David Searle today, and I missed out the Monday session, unfortunately. And what I was saying to him was that within the Anglican Church, for example, within Christianity in general in England, in Britain, I should say, there's going to be a parallel sort of church. You're going to have a state church rather like in Russia, and you're going to have another church of the true church. But here it still speaks about the greed, they'll make up lies. We've seen that so much of the prosperity thing and so on and so forth, and so many people are being dragged away by that. What was he called? Jackie was saying that she, in actual fact, is in a very, very perilous position where she is, with having to face up to, speaking the truth, but facing up to possibly being told that she's going to be accused of being a hate crime. And this is where one thing that I think is very, very, well, it is very worrying. So, he's just saying in chapter two, he mentioned all down there, it's just straight between the eyes, really, isn't it? What's going on now?
And you probably know this, but the second chapter is very, very similar to the letter of Jude. The whole of Jude through some time, you almost feel you're reading to Peter, and it makes you wonder, perhaps they knew each other and they talked about this together, or maybe one read someone else's stuff and it got into theirs. It was important enough for it to be in another whole letter itself, this warning. Anybody else? I can't see any of the hands, but Pat, yes. You're coming in, Pat. You're going to say something because you're still muted. I thought I saw your hand go up. Yeah, there we are.
Yeah, it's just that. Here is Peter, he's imminent, his death is imminent, and he knows that he will be accountable for every word he speaks, and all his, even his very thoughts will speak against him. And yet he has some quite harsh things to say. But truthful things. And he says them.
And that means he must be very sure about it. He must be sure this is what the Lord wants him to say. He must be sure that this is what we need to hear. So, yeah, you're right. It does read a bit like almost his final appeal. Time is short and he needs to say this. And you're right, he knows he's going to be accountable for everything he says. So we can trust him all the more, I think, for that. Yeah. Do we have any other comments? Thoughts? Nobody else I can immediately see. Carolyn, you're unmuted. I don't know if that means you're wanting to say something or it's just left.
Yes, I was thinking about it. I think it's towards the end of the third chapter when he's saying about, since all that we should be, what sort of people ought we to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day?
Yeah.
Which is back to this whole matter of where is our focus?
Yeah.
And also in the first chapter, the ones we were just talking about, the things, the addings on, they're not optional extras, are they? They're essential.
Exactly.
Because that leads to the knowledge of God, which is what he was talking about. So, yeah, that's the two things I saw.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, okay, go on. Rose again, is it? Oh, it's John this time, is it?
chapter 3, verse 16, towards the end, yeah, and it's about twisting words and stuff like that, as did it to their own destruction, as they do also the rest of the scriptures. So effectively, Peter is saying that Paul's letters are scripture.
Well, yes. I know in our translations, it tends to be capitalized a little bit, as though it was already designated as such. I don't know whether the Greek just might mean writings, that point of view, but certainly what Paul was writing about was regarded as being what is the equivalent of scriptures and what would one day become scriptures. And of course, he's always liked the fact that he says, he'd not write some difficult stuff. It's almost as though Peter must have been reading Romans recently and got stuck somewhere around chapter 4 or 5 or something. I like the fact that he refers to Paul towards the end there. So,
John Rogers is waving.
Who is I?
Yeah, hi.
Oh, yeah, again, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, actually, just something that I would like to know if you've got any idea or any thoughts on this, where in chapter 2, verse 10, it says, these people are proud and arrogant, daring even to scoff at supernatural beings without so much as trembling. Could you sort of pass a comment about that or clarify that, who these supernatural beings are, possibly?
Well, I see.
Please.
yeah, so it says in the middle of verse 10, because I was... Bold and arrogant, these men are not afraid to slander celestial beings. Well, it must be the angels. And he goes on in verse 11 to say, yet even angels, though they are stronger, do not bring slanderous accusation against, oh, I see, against such beings in the presence of the Lord. Ah, now, that's an interesting thing, because I was going to say the only celestial beings I really know about are angels. And yet even the angels don't bring accusations against such beings. So, you've thrown me one there, I can't. Because it's the first time I've really thought that it might be that the celestial beings are not so much the angels themselves. so who would these men be?
Betty, not is an idea.
Yeah, Betty?
My concordance says the celestial beings may be angels, all the glories of the unworld world, or more probably fallen angels.
Right.
A similar passage is found in Jude 8 to 10.
Yeah.
Whoever they are, and then it goes on to say, so really saying that we need to be careful because it's the Lord's work to rebuke the enemy.
That does make sense then, because verse 11 goes on to say, even angels, as in good angels, don't bring slanderous accusations against the other angels. They do quite rightly leave it to the Lord. So I suppose the real contrast in the end is that these men are bold and arrogant, whereas even the angels don't go that far, and you'd think that they would have the authority to do that. So, yeah, okay.
Certainly you could see that. You see that in some of the preaching that comes over. Not that I watch it very often, but the other week I was watching. What do they call it? Not that was the week. That was what was it called? It's a satirical program, half an hour each week. And have I got news for you? And there was Kenneth, one of the American preachers there, and he was over the whole television, over the national television. They showed this, and there was this evangelistic preacher. He just said, "Oh, President Trump will not get into power back again," but he was mocking the fact that he will. Not mocking the fact that this being said, and he started laughing. And when anybody saw that, it was absolutely incredible. And this was going over as a Christian on national TV. I mean, he was mocking the fact that just laughing in this most demonic way. And there were people there, they stood up and clapped him. He was laughing about the fact that saying that, oh well, people won't get back in there, but he was saying, oh yes, he will, laughing at I thought these are the sorts of things that you've got in this chapter two. It's pointed out quite magnificently, I think.
Yes.
I don't know if anybody else saw that. No, obviously not.
No, I've given up on a lot of these television programs, which I used to think were entertaining and could still enjoy on one level, but you never quite know what's going to come out and what's going to come across. And I'm trying to sort of make sure I don't watch things that I regret afterwards, either because they make my blood boil or because I feel that they're not wholesome. And it's very difficult.
Yes, I don't give you the idea that I'm watching all these television programs. I'm quite assure you I don't.
No.
This household is a very quiet household. We live in silence here, and it's very, very rare we put the television on.
Yeah, but as I say, I used to find that, it wasn't so bad watching some of these television programs in the past, but I think things have deteriorated, and therefore these programs become vehicles, whether it's comedy or light entertainment, whatever sort of thing, become vehicles for people to, well, act like you just said, really. Anyway, we've gone over our time a little bit, so I'll just round off there, and thank you very much for your comments and so on. I thought it was useful to follow up from Mike. Next week, I'll do one more before my midwinter break. And I've got a few items lined up. And what I thought I'd just tease you with one of them to help you think ahead if you want to. But in Peter's first letter, he refers to us as a royal priesthood or a holy priesthood. It's there in 1 Peter 2, verse 5, by living stones being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood. And more specifically in verse 9, you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, and he goes on, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, and so on. So the question to consider, and it's one I'm trying to tease through a little bit myself, is what does it mean today for us to be a kingdom of priests or a royal priesthood? What would that look like? What should we have to be doing in order to come across like that? And you may know that Peter is actually referring back to something here in the Old Testament. It's a quote almost from something in the past. So it's worth starting there to have a think about it. But I'm going to pick up this idea of what does it mean for us to be a kingdom of priests? What would that look like? What difference would that make to the way we do church and therefore the way the world should see us and benefit from us? So if you get any thoughts on that, store them up ready for our discussion next time. So I'll finish there. Unless there's any more announcements, we'll stop the recording. But I think Steve said it all at the beginning. So